This is The Deep Dive with Brooks Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 High FM.
This is The Deep Dive, as you know, and I'm your host, Brooks Spector, on High FM. And my guest today, reporter, analyst, contemplator of the enormity of things in South Africa, Eve Fairbanks. And we talked to her a few years ago when her book, The Inheritors, came out, which was a look at, it was a look at South Africa's history, recent history, but through the eyes of not famous people, through the eyes of ordinary people, and how they were responding, how were their hopes, their fears, their anxieties, their angers, and their delights all sort of intermingled with the way things have worked out or haven't. And it was a different book from most of the books you read on contemporary South Africa, because if I remember correctly, and I don't have a photographic memory, but if I remember it correctly, there wasn't a famous person that made a real in actual appearance in the book except by reference through
That's right.
the conversation with others. And that itself was very different from most of the contemporary narratives. And that's what I liked most about it. It was as if you were getting out of the car and you were talking to the petrol station attendant. And then you went to the bakery and you talked to the people who were making bread. And then you talked to the guy who delivered stuff for a courier company. And then you found four people you knew sitting around in a cafe who didn't have jobs. Then you found somebody who had managed to transcend all of this and become relatively prosperous, but was not famous. And somehow that whole tapestry was stitched together, sort of like a South African version of Balzac's universe, I guess. How does that sound?
That's one of the nicer descriptions that I've read. Yeah, there was a mid-level functionary, an ANC kind of a bureaucrat in Limpopo, but that was probably the highest level person, a lawyer involved in a court case in Bloemfontein. I had been a reporter. I started out at a magazine called The New Republic, covering in Washington, covering the Obama campaign in 2008, his first presidential campaign. And there was such an emphasis, I think this is true all over, but such a laser emphasis. We were all running around following Obama, John McCain, a very, very narrow set of just bold face names, icons. There would often be events where there were far more reporters than ordinary people. And you were also following people who had gotten to where they were partially and been trained to by being very hard to read, by being a product for public consumption, by not being too frank at the wrong times. And so I took a different approach with that book. But now we have a discussion about two 1990s icons in a certain way, being appointed ambassadors, the U.S. ambassador to South Africa, and now the news about the South African ambassador to the United States. So that's something else.
That's the topic I wanted to approach. And in a way, the two individuals couldn't be more different. In the case of Ralph Mayer, you can explain to me why there are some similarities too. In the case of Ralph Mayer, he came up through the old National Party and became a significant player in the cabinet of the late term apartheid era. He's perhaps most famous for a fishhook. People remember that.
Yes.
He and Cyril Ramaphosa were in a game farm or a fishing lodge, and the mayor was about to teach his two sons how to fish and then managed to get the hook stuck in his hand. And Ramaphosa, with a pair of pliers or a Swiss Army knife, extracted it. And the two figured out a way forward in large respect. For the way in which the negotiations, underline the word negotiations, would be transacted. And over time, he became a cabinet member in the new transitional government, and then in the government that followed that. And then he left his National Party roots and joined the ANC, and then joined with Bantu Holomisa for the United Democratic Movement, and then went into business along the way and left politics largely. And now he's named ambassador to the United States. The parallel, in a way, Leo Brent Bozell III comes from a conservative political royalty in America, in a way. His father had connections to William F. Buckley. Bozell was a, he did his spade work in the media criticizing all of that left-wing anti something or other media and established an organization that would hunt down errors in reporting, did a film for the Contras in Nicaragua against the Sandinistas, established various publications, was an early organizer for the National Conservative Political Action Committee way back when, and written or partially written 4 or 5 books about his journey and his experiences. And then he was tapped as ambassador from the United States to South Africa. I'm visualizing the dining room table where these two men are sitting there trying to figure out how they're going to move their respective governments to a greater amity as opposed to enmity.
Well, if that's even the goal on the U.S. side, I mean, to me, especially now that you bring up all of that back history, they're both very interesting insofar as each man, you could say, represents a certain vibe that their respective countries had in the 90s and what the country rewarded, what their society, their respective societies rewarded and was starting to reward in the 1990s and felt like they needed politically. So in the case of Mayer, you know, it's somebody who had this national party background, I think as a Verluchte, as a younger in the 80s and early 90s, a younger at that time, more reformist minded person, but still with a fairly traditional background and national party, but somebody who was able to form these personal relationships with Ramaphosa, but not only Ramaphosa, and including with people on his own side to try to bring factions together who really weren't expected to be able to get along, to compromise, to create something new out of what had been a terribly stuck dynamic. Someone with a kind of private and personal touch and a sort of a bridge builder. Brent Bozell, on the other hand, my family was involved in conservative politics and neoconservative politics when I was young. My father worked for Reagan, and so I ran across Bozell at, I don't know, parties at that little circle. And he was someone who was at such pains to present himself as a gadfly, an outsider, a kind of a gotcha artist, almost like, you know, a person who would show up at a press conference of an ordinary politician and stand up and start yelling and ask some question that's supposed to reveal and humiliate, you know, a public figure, gotcha, like, and somebody who was perceived even then to really be interested in the kind of 1990s version of cliques, which would have been eyeballs on cable TV, you know, subscriptions to newsletters, and who would be willing to say outrageous things. You didn't necessarily get the sense that, I don't want to dump on Bozell unnecessarily, but that he really felt it was that important to believe what he was saying. It was more about establishing a public profile, because, you know, finding a position for himself on the margin of what was normally acceptable to say, but and getting a kind of position politically in that manner. So they're really kind of opposites, as you say, in a sense, but they also show what these two societies that were existing both after the collapse of the Soviet Union at the end of the Cold War, but that were looking for and rewarded a very different kind of way of operating politically. Is it about keeping cards close to your chest, trying to massage over differences if needed to create at least a temporary bridge to common ground? Or is it about asking the questions that nobody else dares asking, stretching the boundaries of acceptable politics, question, making politics more severe, more ideological. I think that's they do contrast in that way.
I read a lot of Bozell's books preparatory to his coming here. I'm one of these people who actually sat down and read them.
Amazing.
Four in a weekend. I mean, it was a mind-boggling experience.
That's
to do
a lot of Bozell.
I'll tell you, I was sort of like steeped in a rich soup of it. But I got the feeling that he had created a kind of Gestalt for himself, just as you say, someone who could be there right at the edge of that bubble, push and try to extend the bubble rather than burst it. And he did this with film. He did this with his lobbying activities. He did it with his truth and media efforts. He did it with his television appearances and his written commentaries. And all of it seemed to be to prove something about who he was and what he believed rather than being about what he believed, if you see the difference. I don't recall Mayer as having had a major public presence, more of an insider trying to chivvy change happening and, as you correctly note, bringing along elements of his own then political party to that table to meet up with the other side or other sides, I guess, more realistically. We're going to take a very quick ad break, and then we'll be right back for our conversation with author, journalist Eve Fairbanks. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host on Chi FM. But stay tuned. Don't touch that dial, as we would have said back in the 1970s. This is The Deep Dive.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and I'm pleased to have my guest after some years, actually, Eve Fairbanks, who wrote a very interesting and useful book, The Inheritors, which, as we said right at the outset, looked at South Africa's evolution through the eyes mostly of ordinary people rather than all the big noises and big cheeses. In that sense, revelatory for people who were used to thinking only about the giant seismic changes done by large personalities and great men and women. And we're talking, though, not about her book, which is still in, I've seen copies still in bookstores, and it's worth picking up and reading, I must tell you. I did, twice. We're talking about the appointment of Rolf Mayer as South Africa's designated ambassador to the U.S. and Brent Bozell, who was America's ambassador to South Africa. The question that comes to mind, and you have a view on this, the two countries seem to be stuck in a relationship that's in some ways very close, in other ways they're frenemies, and in other ways, there are antagonisms. And both of them are going to be charged with representing their government's positions and at the same time having to work their way through the antagonisms so that there is some forward motion, some progress, some greater appreciation and understanding. Is it possible to do that kind of thing?
It's a really good question. And I actually think especially on Mayer's side, in a sense, I mean, there'll be an opportunity to see what in the contemporary era an ambassador could really do. Obviously, ambassadors were more important when there wasn't the internet, wasn't the telephone, and, you know, telegrams were even really challenging because they really had to represent in far-flung places governments that couldn't, you know, where the president just couldn't pick up a horn, somebody couldn't send the text message. They were on the front line in that sense. And ambassador has become quite a weird job. It's almost more important, the less important, or the less kind of big and central the country is, because with, you know, the ambassador, United States to the UK, or from the United States to France, or South Africa's ambassador to Nigeria, or even historically to the United States, it's a hard job because it's really only possible to mess it up. There's not typically all that much you can do that's really kind of exceptional or moves balls forward, because so much of interaction on very important things like the African Growth and Opportunity Act, naval exercises, sort of major points of foreign policy between two countries are now going to happen at other levels within government, foreign
and
affairs,
state actors that you have no control over.
Exactly. So you
No, I was going to say, I've made the point here that one of the biggest tasks for somebody like Ralph Mayer is not to spend effort needlessly trying to get, you know, FaceTime with a president, but getting to know and understand and to convey ideas and understandings to congressional staff members and lower levels of governmental organizations where ideas are formulated, but where they're not making major public presentations or statements about grand and large things.
In the I think 18th, that's really important.
An ambassador went there and, you know, like a month or two later, might get a response to a letter. Now it's, you know, the turnaround is about 2 milliseconds.
Yeah, what you say is very important. Of course, the previous ambassador was Ebrahim Rasool. My personal opinion is he was somewhat over-criticized. It's debatable, but in part because, again, you are not going to, you know, one of his missions, because I spoke to him somewhat around that period and had been to, he had kind of grand ambitions, I think, to reset relations and probably more than an ambassador could do. And partly in order to try to do that, he did public talks and, you know, was attempting a kind of public rhetoric. An ambassador can really, they're not going to say anything in such a circumstance that's going to move and shake, move mountains in a positive way. Their only option by doing that really is to stick their foot in their mouth in such a large manner that it becomes a news story. But
I really like that. I really like that insight. I mean, because it's very hard to pinpoint what ambassadors have succeeded with. And it's really easy to pinpoint, you know, where it was, shouldn't have done that.
However, if you look at why South Africa became such a bee in the bonnet for Trump, it's a complex story. But I think people can focus a little bit too much on marquee names like Elon Musk, Sachs, Pollack at Breitbart, certain conservative figures who have either are South African, have a longstanding interest in South Africa, and may have whispered in Trump's ear. That exists. But the truth is that there's also a layer of staffers, lower level people in Vice President Vance's office within the executive branch, but who are in their 20s and 30s, and they are trying to, they may have a real interest in South Africa for whatever reason, but they're also trying to find an issue that will kind of interest a very mercurial president with very divided, you know, a very scattered attention span, and really push a certain brief. And so what I have heard, and this is not just me, but that there are staffers within Vance's office that you actually see, Offer Forum has gone and met and lobbied, younger people within congressional staffs within the executive branch who have really pushed a certain depiction of South Africa and gotten that to rise to the level of prompting the kind of actions that Trump has taken that are startling, which have a longer history than just the Trump administration, this kind of difficult relations between the U.S. and South Africa. But that is something that an ambassador can do, is behind the scenes, reach out to those younger people. I think it's a very patriotic thing to take this ambassadorship, because you're going to be in Washington. You're going to have to spend a lot of time meeting people who are going to say a lot of things in all kinds of dimensions about the country that you privately, that don't make any sense to you because they've never been there. They've read a couple books. They have some idea that they're pressing. It's very tedious. It's a very, very tedious job being an ambassador. But I also think it can still be done well, especially right now, if you have an interest in that lower to mid-level kind of working behind the scenes discussions. So we'll see if that's going to be of interest to Mayor.
And that's going to be the task for, I think, both men. Eve, I'm sorry, we have to wind it up because you have appointments, and it's been a delight once again to speak with you. We'll do it again. We'll do it at another point where we get to evaluate whether our judgments collectively were right on the mark, or we missed the big picture, or we found it perfectly. We'll do that again. We've been speaking with author, journalist Eve Fairbanks. Best known creation, The Inheritors, is a book audience members should pick up and read. It moves gently and quickly, and it gives you insight into this country that you might not otherwise have, which is interesting in its own way. And we have been talking about the role of ambassadors, and in particular, the newly named Ralph Mayer ambassador to the U.S. and the Leo Brent Bazell III, recently arrived American ambassador to South Africa. And this is The Deep Dive, and we will be back again with guest number two on another topic in just a few minutes. You stay right there. Don't go away.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I am your host, Brooke Spector, as usual, on High FM. And today's guest is Professor Peter Bauer from the University of Johannesburg. And we are going to talk about, not surprisingly, economic issues, and in particular, we want to touch bases on the recently released, I think it was just 2 days ago, the International Monetary Fund's report on the world economic outlook. And to be blunt about it, the world's economic outlook, according to the IMF, was a little darker than it might have been, shall we say. Let me just read the first couple of lines of their report, because I think it sort of sets the scene for our discussion. After withstanding higher trade barriers and elevated uncertainty last year, global activity now faces a major test from the outbreak of war in the Middle East. Assuming that conflict remains limited in duration and scope, global growth is projected to slow to 3.1% in 2026 and 3.2% in 2027. Global headline inflation is projected to rise modestly in 2026 before resuming its decline in 2027. Slowdown in growth and increase in inflation are expected to be particularly pronounced in, little drum roll here, I think, ominous music, particularly pronounced in emerging market and developing economies. And I think that kind of points toward places like South Africa. I mean, I remember when the IMF was painting a much rosier picture about a future, a low inflation, high growth, global stability world, and it was led by places in particular, China, which were growing at 7.5-8% a year or better. And now, if I read these numbers correctly, and if I understand them properly, and Peter, you'll have to help me on this, what this is really saying is that a place like China or Indonesia or India or some of the other middle-sized economies, they're not growing at those numbers anymore. They're now dropping, and that means places that are smaller and less prone to growth, like South Africa, their numbers are bad. They're not good. They're within shooting distance of 0% or something terrible like that. So with that wonderful, optimistic, and positive introduction, Peter Bauer from the University of Johannesburg, assistant professor of economics, help us understand all this, and what does it mean, and what should we be hiding under the table, or should we be out in the street celebrating, or should we be doing something else?
Well, I think let's bring it into context. The numbers that you're referring to from the IMF is assuming already that this particular conflict is going to be short-lived. If, however, the conflict expands over a longer duration or a longer period of time, I think that's where we could really consider ourselves to be in a little bit of trouble. In the moment, we're talking about the global economy, as you mentioned earlier, dropping the growth in the global economy, dropping down to about 3.1%. And we're looking at probably a rise of to about 4.5% in global inflation. So in other words, as we're currently looking forward, we're seeing that the relative strength of currencies around most of the world is actually weakening. So exports are Or shall we let's rephrase, prices against the US dollar are going to become a challenge. And especially for a country like South Africa, where a large part of our export production is also, so shall we say, supported by import of goods, including technology, and other, semi-manufactured goods that come into South Africa, we get processed and re-exported again. This is going to be particularly harmful, for example, the automotive industry. Motor car sales and trade for automotive industries are going to be as well particularly hit. Manufactured goods are going to be hit. And so, that's a mild case. But if we were to take it a little further and say, like a more extreme case, as this progresses, as this conflict continues, without end, we probably start seeing inflation, global inflation rising to about 5.4%. And we'll start seeing, for example, global economic growth moving down to the 2% and even lower. And according to the IMF report, what we've also noticed is it's actually the developing countries and the low-income countries that are actually going to be impacted the most by this. So the drop in economic growth can be anything up to 1 to 2% per economy. Now, for an economy like South Africa, well, let's suppose we're sitting at an economic growth with around 1% in the moment. A dropping global, shall we say, growth implies that especially for a country like South Africa that relies heavily on export trade. Now we sell a lot of goods, both primary and secondary goods to economies like China, to the European Union, to America, etc. And so if these economies are now slowing down, let's talk about our, shall we say, our Near East, or even places like India or China in the Far East, it means that we're exporting less to them. But now for South Africa, this becomes, I would say, a bit of a compounded problem. The compound here is that we're currently sitting at reasonably high and persistent unemployment within the country. These are mostly, obviously, structural dynamics within the country. It's very difficult as it is to be able to reduce our current unemployment rate, given, for example, skills levels. We're working diligently towards improving all of that, but by the time the skills are matching what the economy needs, a number of years have already passed, and so these unemployment challenges that we're sitting with are
And those
persistent.
skills need to have changed
Yes,
to some
absolutely.
degree.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we could just tie it up with a very simple example, and I'm sorry to deviate just ever so slightly, but I mean, if you take a
No,
look
go
at
ahead.
AI-related industries, they say, like, for example, there was a study done in Europe, and they said, something like, I mean, figuratively speaking, let's assume about 750,000 jobs lost due to AI directly. But AI is going to create a new set of jobs, which will probably create, let's say, additional 1.5 million jobs. So double amount of jobs created through AI. But the people who are losing their jobs due to AI are not necessarily employable within the sector that is now those jobs that are created by AI. So it's a different kind of skill dynamic, which what we are seeing in South Africa is one of our biggest challenges with our structural unemployment is even as the economy is modifying and changing, we're not necessarily seeing the kind of skills that are required for an evolving economy. So we're sitting with a persistent high unemployment and a relatively low level of economic growth. And much of our growth is generated through trade with key performers, European Union, as I said, America and China, India, etc. Now, here's the big challenge coming in, is as those
I have a
economies are
couple of
slowing down,
questions on that too, but go ahead, finish that
yes,
off.
absolutely.
I'm going to pose
As
some
we're
interesting
starting,
points here.
yeah, and as exports, let's say to China and India, etc., may be affected by their own export markets, China's 5% economic growth is very heavily dependent on exports themselves. Global economy in China, well, global economy slows down means China exports slow down, which means China's economy slows down, which means that then filters down to us. Another challenge in South Africa is we're a very open economy. So we deal very extensively with other economies. We're open to the effects of other economies that we deal with. So we import their challenges. We import their inflation. We import their low growth. We import all those problems into our economy, which is then compounding where we are standing in South Africa. Now, this doesn't imply that now we all need to go lay back and slit our wrists and panic. I don't believe that at all. I think that the market dynamics are also changing right now. So we are seeing significant shifts in new trade relationships being developed over the last, shall we say, 2 years. Between South Africa and other, shall we say, developed countries. So, where, for example, through the Trump administration, we may have seen the impact of tariffs impacting many countries around the world. The trade dynamics have shifted. So, globally, European Union, Asia, even Americas are looking for new trade partners. And so, there's a bit of strength in this because Africa is obviously very resource rich. Well, a very large economy that's growing, that's now technologically hungry. It's evolving going forward, and so there are new markets that are becoming available. And so, for an economy like South Africa, where it's not as in a hardcore negative, but it's more, shall we say, a shift in dynamics and perspectives in how we are able then to contribute now to the global economy going forward. The possibilities are higher increase, or should we say, an increase in unemployment in South Africa. And I believe we are already starting to see that unemployment pressure going up already due to these dynamics.
I want to go back a little bit to where you were when you were talking about the auto industry, the mismatching skill sets of people as the economy itself changes. As I understand, let's take the auto part first. As I understand it, almost all of South Africa auto industry is geared toward internal combustion and diesel engine production. There's basically no electric vehicle production on this continent, really, let alone in South Africa. And yet, that is quite clearly where the world is shifting. And countries like China are busily producing more electric vehicles than the rest of the world combined. And that is going to make a major impact on South Africa's production of motor vehicles. Second question for you, when we talk about the mismatch of skills, 15 years ago, if you were to tell someone to go to university and study the hot topic, the hot subject, you would tell them learn computer coding and how to write code and how to design code. And now, of course, computer coding is being done by the AI world, which doesn't require human intervention anymore. AI is beginning to write its own code about itself. The doomsayers will talk about that being a singularity moment when we simply run out of runway and the rest of us are left over. But it is true that in places like the United States, the coding majors in universities are declining because they have discovered that, uh-oh, this is not the future after all. I guess tying those two pieces together, the question derives, how do you plan an economy that is an open and significantly free capitalist economy to respond effectively, not to the individual market changes, but the much larger global challenges, autos, coding, mismatch of skills. You have like 8 minutes to explain all of that rather than a lecture, rather than a semester.
Okay. Yes. And to all of your points, you're absolutely correct. 100%. These are really very valid points. In terms of the automotive industry and us still producing, shall we say, diesel, petrol,
Sorry, I'm
combustion
going to.
engine.
This is the Deep Dive, and I am your host, Brooke Spector. My guest today, assistant professor at the University of Johannesburg in economics, Peter Bauer. We're busy trying to understand the IMF's report and the larger implications. And we're going to break for these commercial messages, and we will be right back after those messages.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector on High FM. And my guest today, the second guest actually, Professor Peter Bauer at the University of Johannesburg in economics. And he is gamely trying to explain the entirety of the global economic future. And we have about 15 minutes left to do it. So, Peter, again, let's go back to where you were going to start with that big question that I posed to you.
Okay, great, thanks. Yes, we are producing combustion engine motor vehicles, which we are trading to the rest of the world. But I think there's still a little bit of a lag in terms of how quickly these electro motor cars are actually being absorbed into the global economy. In the moment, given the rapid increase in, shall we say, global petrol prices and diesel prices, suddenly electro engines have suddenly become a lot more, shall we say, attractive. But to really have an impact on the global economy, I think there's a bit of a lag until these electro cars actually come on stream. Biggest challenges would be, for example, infrastructural dynamics. Are there enough grids, as in supporting, for example, refuel spots where electric cars can charge up? The durability of motor car batteries, the range at which these cars can travel. These are all big questions. Great for busting around a city, etc., but not so great if you want to go explore, for example, an African continent. So, they are different kind of markets based for the, but it's going to take a little while until those industries really start kicking in. And I think in the meantime, the huge shift, the global shift towards green energy and alternative energy will then further support those form of infrastructural development. So we've got some time, and that. But at the same time, what we're seeing is many of the motor car industries are evolving their technology. So there's this gap in terms of technological evolution, both within the combustion engines and, of course, the electro engines. So there's that time to develop. And for us in South Africa, I think we must recognize that we are actually right up there with the big boys in terms of research, development, technology advancements. Gearing our economy and our system slowly towards supporting these industries in a bigger and better way. So we're on our way, and I think the lag is there, but there are still markets for our products that we export. In terms of the technology side and the skill base of the younger generations, I think they are going to be faced with very different challenges that we were experiencing back in the day. I think a half of me would love to say, okay, fine. When you were learning computer programming 15 years ago, there were different bases in terms of language that you were using and programming languages and programming skills. And you had to continue to update your skills and improve and evolve. So somebody who's learned programming, for example, more recently is probably more up to date than somebody who's learned the programming 15 years ago. But there are obviously adaptations and changes that have been taking place over time. But this fear of with regards to AI and the super AI they refer to it as, where it now teaches itself or reprograms itself, is an incredibly frightening line for example, those that are going into that AI direction, or at least going to the programming core. There's always going to be room for programmers, absolutely. But I think at the same time, I think there's this fear concept of AI taking that away from people is probably we should maybe break it down into AI is actually facilitating small businesses and facilitating people who haven't had the computer program now to develop better software packages for their own businesses to actually use AI to develop and strategize and streamline technology to better support their businesses. So we're seeing from an entrepreneurial side, we've seen from the younger generations, our Gen Zs, for example, having greater access and opportunities that way. And then, of course, those with experience before obviously finding room to evolve their businesses because this has actually opened the doors for more people to access. Shall we say, more sophisticated programming structures and techniques that will support their businesses. So from that perspective, yes, this is we are seeing the multiple shift, but this again raises a key global concern. If we are seeing the development dynamic taking place, are we now going to see, shall we say, a dualism starting to develop within the global economy? Those who have access to education, those who have access to skills, will they at the end of the day, if you don't have access, you're still not going to be able to fit into that part of the economy. Those that have access, those that are privileged, will have then access into those sectors of the economy. And so that dualism gap is growing. And I think we're going to see this on a global scale as well. And that's going to impact very much on the developing economies. But if you, I mean, just take a look at the number of innovations that are coming from your emerging economies. They're really very high and competitive with those that are coming from the developed countries. In some case studies, I've read that there are more innovations, coming from the emerging economies than they were actually coming from the developed countries. So it's going to become an issue of where are the resources concentrated? Which countries are going to have access to those resources? I think for an economy like South Africa, or at least within the African continent, our challenge is we're dependent on USA, Europe, or even China for access to that AI platform. And that is a very frightening place. Maybe at this stage in our development history, we should really be focusing on what are we doing to really advance AI infrastructure in South Africa. And I know we are. I attended the investment Gauteng investment conference last week, and they were talking about the steps and the drive to support and build better technology infrastructure to support Gauteng's economic growth. So the plans are there. But the concentration of resources are going to be a concern, especially when we take a look at those global shifts. The IMF, for example, is mobilizing additional funding now to support countries that are going to be negatively impacted by this low economic growth going forward. And they're talking about making more funds available than we've released during the COVID era. I think in the COVID era, it was something only about 70 billion or something. And now it's like 80 or 90 billion. It's a larger number that they, so it gives you an idea already that IMF is taking the situation very seriously, this lower economic growth, and in the sense that the support packages are getting bigger. And so we are going to be faced with this, the constraints of this lower economic growth, but it's the duration of which the Middle East conflict is going to continue, that's actually going to impact on how heavy that overall impact is going to be. We're already making significant strides, at least within South Africa, in terms of energy stabilization, infrastructure, energy infrastructure development, and technological infrastructural development. We're making significant strides there. My concern again is that, and it really ties up with who the communities are then supporting, because a lot of individuals who shall we say are earning and a salary in South Africa, also using a big chunk of that salary to support, shall we say, to support those that are unemployed. Let's use an example, expanded definition. Official definition, we're looking at about 35% unemployment approximately. Then you've got the expanded, which goes to about 45% unemployment. So it's like one in two people. So an income earner is in effect supporting more than one person. Let's suppose that income, the challenge here is that there are fewer resources that are now distributed throughout the household to support the growth of those skills of those people in those, shall we say, disadvantaged environments. And so there comes now a new challenge. And it is like, a human right is the, shall we say, access to health and access to electricity. But I think a human right now, we can expand that a little bit further to say it's access to technology and access to these systems. So I think greater support is definitely required to bring everybody on board. And as you mentioned, we need to go right back to maybe even earlier schooling structures. And but what we are seeing is those that didn't have that kind of opportunities previously are now like at least with businesses, small businesses using AI to give greater access is also having another complex and interesting significant impact. Our entrepreneurs are now actually growing faster. They have better the entrepreneurs are using this. The younger generations have who are using it are making good use of it and are growing. But it's the share of that economy that don't have that don't have those fundamental support systems, given our position in terms of unemployment, the structured unemployment, and of course the broader based economic growth. So we kind of could use really take advantage of this AI boom to drive higher levels of economic growth. But again, the global economy is now definitely going to put additional pressure on us.
Let's, in the remaining blah, 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 2.5 minutes or so, tie all of that back to the IMF's rather profoundly distressing projection of a, even if the Middle East conflict is tamped down in the next couple of weeks. Global growth is going to slacken. Global inflation is going to rise. And particularly in countries like this one, the effects are going to be more pronounced than they will be in Western Europe, the US, or even China. You have 2 minutes now to explain all of that, if you could. I'm sorry to give
Okay.
you a push, but
Yeah, no,
time
absolutely.
waits for no man.
Yes, that's right. Okay, so yes, our big challenge there is sitting that we are going to see lower levels of global economic growth. It's funny enough, it's like this generalized pyramid kind of scheme. Economic growth will always be there if you have a growing population. But with a growing population, a global population, we need additional support structures in place to support the growing population. And that implies that we need higher levels of economic growth around the world. When economic growths are now starting to slack off, it's going to impact on obviously businesses on all kinds of different levels. But most importantly, it's going to impact on how countries valuing their own currencies against, for example, the US dollar. So for many economies around the world, this could imply very much that the value of trade for them, importing goods becoming more expensive, and even while they have greater opportunities to export, imports and the contribution to the global economy is going to actually take a lot of strain. So overall, going forward, South Africa, I think we're a really robust economy. And I think we've seen through us our way through really challenging times before. But the shifting, changing market structures, trade dynamics between, for example, South Africa and our trade partners, brought about by the shall we say, the tariff impact of the US administration, has already created new opportunities for us, both across Europe and Asia, et cetera. And that, I think, is going to also counter effect some of this economic growth concerns that we're experiencing. So yes, it may have an overall impact on labor absorption into South African economies. It's going to most likely impact the level of economic growth from our own economy. But overall, I think we can, by taking a look at the way in which the world is shuffling, I think we're more resilient than we were just 2 years ago, as we've already seen changes starting to take place, new dynamic markets starting to form. And obviously, this growth of this technological evolution is going to play a significant role in helping us to overcome many of these challenges. Does that help?
Somehow, I did not expect an economist. I really didn't expect an economist to give me a modified optimistic view. I mean, out of adversity comes progress. So I appreciate that. That gives me a little bit of heart on where we are. Unfortunately, we do have to end with Peter Bauer of the University of Johannesburg, economics professor. We touch bases with him occasionally. And he has delivered what is, I think, curiously, a modified optimistic view about the current global economic crisis as outlined in the International Monetary Fund's report. I'm pleased to hear that. I wasn't ready for that. Let me put it that way. Previously, in the earlier half hour, we had a chat with Eve Fairbanks, author and journalist, and we were talking about the two new ambassadors, the American ambassador in South Africa and the South African who will be going to Washington soon, presumably, Ralph Mayer. We sensed a little bit of progress and some optimism in that process too. My normal glass half empty with the hole at the bottom has now been patched, and maybe we got some water coming into the glass. Anyway, Peter, thank you very much for joining us. This has been the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector on IFM. And we hope to see you again, to listen to you all again, to hear you as an audience. That's bad for you to hear us as an audience next week at this time. And we will have another topic. I have no idea what it'll be, but I guarantee you it will be something you want to know more about. For the Deep Dive, take care, have a good weekend, and thank you for listening.